Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, the 20th of September. Man, we're moving through the summer quick, season to season. I hope you're doing well. Lots going on in Earth Ancients and the world of anomalous ancient civilizations, discoveries, and just general information. You know, it's funny. Every day I find something unique enough to post on my Facebook page. And remember, the Blog Talk Radio program you're listening to, Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past, is based on the Facebook page of the same name. Now, last week I announced that I will be launching a website, Earth Ancients website, which will have specifics, it'll have my articles, it'll have books that I'm releasing and books that I've written. And I mentioned that I'm going to try to get that website up in about a month. And it's funny because during the day, I'm a marketing specialist, and I've been doing websites. I've been designing websites for, about 20 years. I'm not a programmer. I'm more of a designer, a graphic designer, and a marketing specialist. And so I understand a lot of the concepts that go into the design, but there's a phenomenon known as WordPress, and it's a whole new style of web designs, and it's evolving. It's forcing a lot of people to evolve their concept on what is needed, what is useful on a website. And these WordPress websites are big, they're flashy, they're easy to put up, quite remarkable. So I'm looking forward to posting some really fun photographs that I've been collecting over the last 30 years or longer, combining that with what is on Facebook, selective group of photos that have been archived on Facebook, and allowing people to really get into some of the details of ancient civilizations, some of the ruins, lots and lots of Mayan ruins, because that's my personal interest and favorite. So that'll be out in probably about a month. Let's talk a little bit about some of the Facebook material that I've published in the last week. One of the most interesting phenomenons, and we spoke about it with Mike Barra, who wrote a book called Ancient Aliens on Mars a few weeks ago. A phenomenon with Mars is their moons. And Phobos 1 and Phobos 2 orbit around Mars, and they're both kind of odd-looking moons, like they were at one time asteroids that crashed into each other, or not sure. But the images that have been coming out of Phobos 2 are quite amazing. And Mike Barra reported a number of weeks ago that it's been well known by Russian scientists that Phobos 2 is artificial. And what that means is the orbit is seems to be corrected artificially. And I'm not a astrophysicist, but that's a very significant claim. And the reason that, the bottom line is because the orbit is corrected artificially, the scientists say that it's a alien craft. Some race of beings created this massive planet or moon or structure, whatever it is, and it is orbiting Mars. Now, in the photograph that I published just this morning, Barra has revealed in this new photograph the actual surface of the Phobos 2 of this planet, artificial planet, and it's a very unusual angled mesh pattern. It's all over the body of the moon, and you got to take a look at it. It's quite fascinating. It's one of the most amazing photographs I've seen, and I've seen quite a few close-ups. But the camera on the satellite that was circling Mars had some kind of imaging characteristics or properties that allowed it to photograph the whole body of the moon, and you can see these mesh-like crisscross patterns that are all over the surface. So I don't know. I think period when the Russians were planning on shooting another satellite to try to get close to Phobos again. They've tried it twice, and in one case, it's very controversial. The satellite was intercepted by something from the planet of Mars. Okay, well, what does that mean? What does something mean? Well, remember, our whole thing here on Earth Ancients is to keep the whole alien question out of the discussion. But in this case, they actually took a photograph. The satellite took a photograph as this object was coming close to it, and apparently there was a collision or some kind of array, or we don't know. They don't know either. But the satellite was destroyed. So lots of questions about Phobos and Mars. So take a look at that. The title is Image of Phobos 2 Implies Artificiality. And it's a question that I continue to have. In fact, I think I'm probably going to put some of my archived photographs up there again later in the week so people can take a look at that. Another area that I have brought up on the Facebook page is the tunnels that are discovered under the Pyramid of the Serpent at Teotihuacan in Mexico. And it's been reported for the last couple of years that there were tunnels under the pyramid, and there was a question as to what these tunnels were. Now, remember, we've talked repeatedly about the work of John Burke and his focus on the telluric or the electromagnetic fields that are naturally occurring in various parts of the globe, and how a number of native cultures, the Maya and some earlier unknown cultures, used and amplified these telluric geomagnetic fields up through magnetic rock or pyramids. And in his case, he believes they were used for enhancement of crop seeds and things like that. But of course, that's a lot of energy, a lot of design and engineering just for enhancing crops and seeds and things like that. And it's my feeling that, at least with the Maya, they and we've talked about this before, but I'm going to bring it up real quickly. They probably channeled in some manner this telluric field, which was, you know, converted to, it was actual electricity in some respects, and used it to power various devices and conveniences. When I say conveniences, today's conveniences are hair dryer, kitchen blender, ranges, refrigerators. Of course, we have no reference of anything like that with the Maya, but perhaps there is, at some point in the future, we'll find some devices or things. But also, a big component that I was turned on to by the elders who I spoke to when I would travel in Mexico was the fact that there was a human consciousness expansion point of view. There was also a physical enhancement through meditation, but also when they would sit in these pyramids, and they, and various places have chambers and rooms. If you go to Uxmal, there's the Pyramid of the Magician, and there's chambers in there that you can sit. Of course, at the top of Chichen Itza, and in Tikal and Coba, even Tulum, the small city or complex of buildings that is on the Caribbean Ocean, has little rooms that are made only to sit and either meditate or commune with nature or whatever. And in many cases, we now know, many years later, as our technology has been refined, that these rooms, spaces, or chambers were part of an overall complex that, in many cases, were powered or were being bathed in geomagnetic or telluric fields. So we know that. We know that for a fact. Orthodox science does not really measure telluric fields or geomagnetic fields and discuss it. It has to be outside researchers like John Burke and people like my guest today. And my guest today is Carlton Brown, and I'm really happy to have him on the program because he has done some phenomenal research into not just pyramid technology, but the science behind its connection to human, what I think is evolution, and human consciousness. Now, Carlton is a veterinarian, he's a biotech entrepreneur, vaccine innovator, and he's a hobby archaeologist researcher. His new book, his first book actually, is Sun God Sacred Secrets. And Carlton's quite a fellow. He raised 23 million pounds, which I think that's quite a bit of U.S. dollars. I think that's double. It's 40 million or more. He'll tell us in a minute. To develop a new vaccine solution for mutating viruses and to solve a multi-decade industry technology bottleneck. So basically, he developed, universal influenza vaccine able to target all potential pandemic flu strains in a clinical testing environment. He's had a lifetime fascination with pyramid archaeology, cultures, lost civilization, mankind's real history through the Holocene period, and its ultimate effect through altered states of consciousness. Kind of sounds like my interest, too. Sounds like me. It's like I'm looking in the mirror. The fascinating thing about Carlton is that he's actually, and he'll tell us more about this in a second, he's actually traveled the world and been to many of these places that he describes in his book. And he actually currently lives, and he is coming to us today from Guatemala, Lake Atitlan, which is at the heartland of where a number of the ancient Maya lived. And I think there's quite a few that are still there, too. So welcome to the program, Carlton. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you very much, Cliff. Thank you very much for that lovely welcome. And thank you very much, everyone, joining us on the show today. Really appreciate your presence.
Yes. So tell me about Lake Atlan. Is that high elevation, or where what part of Guatemala is that?
Okay. Yeah, we're at about 1,500 meters. We're right on the, you know, in the middle of the Guatemalan highlands, right over a fault line. You know, I live on a house 60 meters above the lake, 7 kilometers from 4 volcano peaks, and sitting in between those volcano peaks is Santiago de Atitlan, which was the former shaman and priest, Mayan sheik and priest capital of Guatemala. So it was a very important place, and there are a number of these places on the face of the planet, vortexes, you know, and Sedona Vortex in the U.S. is one of them, and Lake Atitlan is also considered one of those as well. So it's a very good place.
Yeah, now that's interesting. Sorry. Now you're saying that it's actually, did you pick it because it's on a vortex? Of
Absolutely.
Course, right?
Yeah.
Of course, and we're going to learn more about your interest in vortexes. Tell me real quickly, do you have a chance to interact with any of the local native Maya people there at all?
You know, not so much on a day-to-day, although I do know them. I actually live on an old Mayan shaman site, so we've got a cave next door, ceremonial fire, that, you know, only I use these days. But I've certainly met, you know, probably in total sort of half a dozen shamans as I visit various sites around the country, and you get to talk to a lot of the elderly Maya as well. So, you know, from my point of view, they lost a lot of knowledge, but these guys are a real repository of knowledge, and I think you captured some of that earlier on when you talked about meditation and higher states of consciousness and, you know, the things they used to do.
Oh, so you're saying that if you've had any interaction with the current Maya, they don't seem to have an understanding or any link or focal point to currently using the ruins of their ancestors as places for consciousness rising.
You know, I think there are some of them who do, and some of them who very much respect the old ways. I think there are also shamans who go through the process and not necessarily, certainly some of them I've spoken to, not necessarily deliberately accessing altered states of consciousness. So I think, you know, you get quite a mixture. But you go to these sites on a weekend and you'll see ceremonial fires and shamans around for sure.
Okay, well, that's interesting. I haven't been to Guatemala yet, and I'm planning on getting there soon, but I'm always interested to know how the local populations are, how they interact with the ancient ruins of their ancestors and what they do. So just a few questions there. Okay, well, let's talk about this amazing book. The title is Sun God, Sacred Secrets, The Archaeology, Art and Science of Altered States of Consciousness. Tell me about this book. What was the trigger point for you to delve into this subject of these archaeological wonders, and what made you want to write a book about it?
Sure. No, just very quickly, just to give people some sort of idea, I think the title itself explains very succinctly what the book is about. It's, you know, the archaeology, art, and science of altered states of consciousness, and, you know, this effectively is the doorway into the, you know, the realm of universal consciousness. The book itself is about an archaeological discovery, a shared fingerprint shared by 4 different sun god religions spanning 3 continents and more than 5,000 years of human history. And that fingerprint reveals their sacred ritual processes. So, you know, we'll explain this during the discussion. And then what I do with that is really explain the functional significance of those findings in the context of the sciences supporting altered states of consciousness. And, you know, for me, the big surprise was is what we're being told in the art is identical to what science is telling us. So, you know, in terms of how I got into this project, well, I have a childhood interest. I had a father who introduced me to sort of anomalous thinking, if you like, when I was a little boy. And out of curiosity, I was following all sorts of literature I could before I was 10 years of age and really realizing we didn't know the truth. I had a holiday in Egypt in 2008, and bear in mind, you know, prior to 2008, I'd spent probably 5 years of my life traveling around the world, backpacking, adventures, archaeology, although I didn't realize I was going to become an archaeologist. And so I was reading the book Path of the Poles, which, you know, inspired, I think, Graham Hancock's book Fingerprints of the Gods. And, you know, I just asked the question, you know, if, you know, this catastrophe happened, were the pyramids built before or after the catastrophe? So, you know, and you know, it was when I came home, I began that process of, you know, plotting pyramid maps. And, you know, it was then that things jumped out at me. And I think something else happened to me, you know, 1997 when I was here in Guatemala. And, you know, again, at Lake Atitlan, it just grabs hold of you. You know, it grabs hold of you in a what I would say is an indescribable way. And I slept on Pyramid 2 at Tikal as well, and I had a spontaneous altered states of consciousness, you know, an out-of-body experience, and, you know, that kind of left an impact on me. So I think, you know, when you put that all of those things together, when the things started jumping out at me regarding, you know, the observations I was making with the pyramids, you know, that was the catalyst. And, you know, it probably took me about 6 months or so to put the story together in a crude outline. And it was then I realized I had something very unique. And I also, how do we call it? I watched a video a number of years ago by Jiddu Krishnamurti. So he was a recognized spiritual guru from India. And he was talking about the transformation of man. And he asked the question, what's it going to take to transform humankind? And that question, while I was doing this project, just stuck. And I couldn't, no matter what I did, get rid of it. And ultimately, what I did with the book was answer that question. And, you know, what I really want to get across today to, you know, the listeners is, yes, this is a book on archaeology, but I'm a biologist, being a veterinary surgeon and having spent, you know, my career in pharmaceuticals. And I'm taking a biological approach to what is altered states. And therefore, you know, for me, archaeology is it's a means to an end, and I feel which is a specific filter which is focused around what are the factors we know that science tells us will lead to changes of consciousness. And so, you know, this is things like silent, you know, places of, you know, silence, meditation, electromagnetic and magnetic, acoustic, and also neurochemicals. So whenever I'm doing archaeology, that's my vista.
Okay, well, let's talk about something that is the foundation of your book, exploring these archaeological finds and the science of the sun as it relates to modulating the human brain. Now, tell us why what you discovered in the sun ceremonies and the sacred focus and what it's doing, what you've discovered it does to the brain.
Sure. Do you want these sort of archaeological findings first, or so people have got an anchor, or do you want me to jump straight into the
Let's do the actual structures. And what you've discovered there, and then what you have uncovered in terms of the, if you want to call it amplification of the sun, or the, go ahead and explain what the signs are.
Okay. I think, you know, first off to the listeners out there, there's a downloadable Google Earth KMZ file on my website, so www.carltonbrownv47.com, and there's 450 pyramids and temples. These pyramids, temple sites that I've looked at have an alignment on one of the solstices, the winter solstice sunrise, summer solstice sunset, or the equinoxes. The equinox most frequently at 50%, solstices at 30%. And the conclusion I draw there is, you know, this is about telling time. It's about telling sacred time. And it just so happens that the solstices and the equinoxes coincide with their most important sacred festivals. So these are the times when the leaders got together with their priests and they conducted these special rituals in places of sensory silence. So that was the first observation. Then when you dial out from the, you know, looking down at these sites into the regional level, you noticed another very interesting phenomena, and that is that these sites are aligned or clustered, if you like, into lines. And those, you know, so, you know, if we think about the Maya, you know, 900-kilometer line of pyramids, in South America, it's 1,000 kilometers. In southern India, it's nearly 700K. In the Old Kingdom, you know, of Egypt, it's 100 kilometers. But they sit directly under the day-night boundary. So this is the interface between night and day, what we would call dawn and dusk, if you were looking from space on the winter solstice sunrise, the summer solstice sunset. And the significance of that is, you know, we see a sunrise, we see dawn and dusk on the planet, but what's going on overhead is special electromagnetic physics.
So in each of these places you've been to, the complexes are aligned in such a way. Now, would you say that is a science, architectural design that is not random at all, but it has a basis behind it? Obviously, it must have, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, Cliff, I still scratch my head here because, you know, how do you line these sites up so they're within 2 to 7 minutes of this day-night boundary over, you know, big, big distances? How do you do that? So, you know, I don't have a rational answer for that. You know, the key imperative is that they wanted the empires of states to simultaneously experience these enhanced electromagnetic fields. So there was a deliberate intent. And the fact that, you know, you look at the Maya, 70% of their structures are aligned to the winter solstice sunrise. And you look at these temples, you could be at, Calakmul, you could go to Yaksha. You know, these pyramids look alike. So you know there was a common science, a common, you know, architectural design of these sites over the empire.
Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing is that it's a, you know, here we go back to Civilization X that kind of left its mark around the world with different ancient cultures, and the Giza pyramids, the Maya, in India, maybe even in China, there's alignments like this that is a sacred science. It's a science that we don't know about, and it doesn't make any sense to us today, but obviously it made sense to these megalithic stone builders who built these huge complexes, and there's a lot that we haven't figured out. And but you're beginning to figure out this importance of these alignments, correct?
I think, you know, for me, one of the things I note about this field is it's not very data-driven, and I think, you know, we can critique academia for its lack of different disciplines that it embeds into its, you know, its social sciences, and I think, you know, we've got to look at our own field and realize, you know, we're lacking in data. So one of the things I really wanted to do was I want lots of data points. So, you know, 450 pyramids is pretty significant, 4 different religions. And when you see the same fingerprint, you know, you say, okay, you know, was this random? Well, I think when you see it 4 times, you know, with this level of data, you have to say no. Then you have to say, okay, well, you know, how could that be? And, you know, the reasons I come up with are basically fourfold. You know, one is that there was a common priesthood logic. In other words, this was common sense to them. Not necessarily from our perspective, but from a priest or shaman's perspective. The other is that they were communicating with each other non-locally in altered states of consciousness. I think the third, and this is the thing that, you know, a lot of people in the field have said before, and I'm a believer in, is that there was a precursor civilization that seeded culture throughout the world. And then, of course, fourth, we've got the ET solution. And, you know, I have to, you know, put it on the record, I'm not a fan of ET solutions like yourself.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Carlton, be careful now. Be careful. We don't want to promote that.
No. I was going to say, you know, I think we've got to keep an open mind about ET, but not from a physical point of view. I think from accessing alien UFO experiences and altered states of consciousness. This is described by transpersonal psychologists who've been working in this field for 30, 40 years. So I think there is something potentially there.
Okay. Well, that's another program, but
exactly.
But let me go back to something you just said, which I think is interesting. And I've had kind of an intuition about it too. Is you said one of the points that you had discovered, or what you think about in your hypothesis, is that there were shaman or priests that were communicating among each other in the different cities through kind of like not necessarily telepathy, but they were communicating in altered states of consciousness.
Yes.
Now, explain that a little bit for us.
Okay.
What does that mean?
Sure.
Okay, now we got you on Skype. So
the transpersonal psychology field, and we look at some of the work that, say, Stanislav Grof has done. He describes this capability when we're in altered states. So this is outside of, or we've transcended normal reality. This form of communication is possible.
Okay, so we broke up a little bit here, and we missed the first part of your discussion. So why don't you repeat it again?
Yeah,
repeat it again, because we got Skype beeping in and out. But so again, what is the basis for the your understanding of this the conscious or altered conscious communication, and how did you discover that?
Okay, so again, what I've said is I work back from the biology, and the biology says humans have four states of consciousness: awake, asleep, dreaming, and altered states. And, you know, we've evolved a whole clinical science on altered states over the last 40 years with the birth of the transpersonal psychology field. So guys like Stanislav Grof, who are one of the pioneers of this field, have spent 50 years treating people with things like LSD and holotropic breathing therapy. And they've really categorized and defined the types of phenomena and experiences that are possible. And so this form of non-local communication outside of the body, you know, you're outside of your ego, outside of body, outside of space and time, it's possible to join, if one has the right intentions, join communications and awareness with other people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's good.
So that's the basis of it. And you know, you have to answer the question: why was it important for all of these sites to simultaneously experience these enhanced electromagnetic fields at the same time as they carried out and conducted their sacred rituals? That's the question I've got.
Okay. So this is good, because I've mentioned at the beginning of the program, and we've already talked about it many times, the work of John Burke, the telluric fields, mm-hmm. the geomagnetic fields bubbling up through the ground, and someone from each of these cultures being sensitive enough to know that if they build a pyramid, if they build a structure with magnetic rock, with special cut and formed stones, that these fields are going to be greatly enhanced. And then in your case, you are focusing on the biological point of view, which is what the impact of those fields are on the human brain and body. So go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think we probably need to clarify. I think, you know, what we're doing, we're talking about a fingerprint. So we're talking about an alignment fingerprint and the importance of the solstices and the equinoxes. There's another part to this, this fingerprint, if you like, which is the ritual processes. And it's quite a big topic. But I think if we park that and we come back to it, we can dive into the discussion here that we're having. And so the really important thing about the solstices and the equinoxes is twofold. You know, the solstices generate these enhanced electromagnetic fields in our overhead environments. They permeate everywhere. And they're the sort of frequencies that they use for submarine communication, that the U.S. government's HEART program are using to transmit, electromagnetic waves around the world. And it just so happens, when you look at the biology, that these fields interact with the human body. And, you know, they cause, you know, they do a number of things. You know, Schumann resonances can, you know, enhance reaction speeds, or if they're at very low levels, they can slow down reaction speeds. So we, you know, we biologically respond to them. I think in regard... It's like Teotihuacan, a high in magnetic rock, volcanic rock, and therefore their places of high magnetic energy. You know, if you look at the rest of the Maya built on the, you know, the chalk, limestone Yucatan Peninsula, I wouldn't associate that it necessarily in itself with high magnetic fields. But you've got to remember, this Earth is a magnet. We're bathed in magnetic fields, and there are hot spots over the face of the planet. And it just so happens that on the equinox, these magnetic fields peak in strength. Or when we have solar flares, you know, and we're at the top of the solar cycle, this enhanced magnetic activity interacts with the biology of the human being. And so, you know, when you look at Schumann resonances and magnetic fields, they have one thing in common, and that is they passively supplement or enhance human alpha brainwaves. And those human alpha brainwaves are what we produce when we meditate in sensory silence, and they're what we generate in very high power when we transcend into altered states of consciousness. And the interesting thing is the science shows us they are supplementable. So this is why, you know, this is why you see these religious festivals timed on the winter solstice sunrise, because that's one of the peaks of the year. And it's timed on the summer solstice sunset, another peak time of the year. And then, you know, why we have the equinox festivals on the, you know, they're associated with the equinox, because we have peaks in magnetic activity. And so, you know, these guys, I've no idea how they figured it out over thousands, tens of thousands of years, but they figured out there were times of the year beneficial to conducting these rituals. And when they combine the meditation and the places of sensory silence together with hallucinogens, they were able to trip into altered states. And that was the basis of their religions. Okay. So, you know, these priesthoods were pretty smart people in my mind.
Yes. I think they inherited quite a bit of their knowledge, though. But let's touch base before we go forward. I want you to... And you've explained and you've used the term archaeological fingerprint. can you tell our audience, is there a similarity in the ancient complexes in Giza and in the Yucatan Peninsula with various Mayan locations and I guess India and China? What is the unique, I mean, you talked a little bit about it, is it, it's not only the alignment of these complexes as they are positioned to gain not only the perfect sight lines for the cosmos, for observing the planets and the star systems, but the benefits of picking up Earth energies, telluric energies, things like that. Talk a little bit about that real quickly. Oh, it's not really a quick subject, but kind of give it a highlight, because this is a big point in your book, and it's important to discuss.
The key thing for me is, you know, what we've done is we've talked about alignments, and alignments tell time. And they tell us, you know, these are times of enhanced, you know, energy fields, if you like. And, you know, the other component of that is, of course, all of these sun god religions were housed in lightning centers along the same longitude as lightning centers. And lightning centers are big generators of these electromagnetic waves, these Schumann resonances. So, you know, they understood the biological impact of that. But the most important part of this fingerprint that the different civilizations share in common is that they embedded their ritual processes in deity, art, and icons associated with these sun god temples and pyramids. So, you know, when we look at Egypt, for example, you know, we see these pharaohs' busts, you know, these heads with these Mimes cloths, you know, this 47-degree angle, and we see the serpent in their forehead. We can, you know, this is delineating sacred time. That 47 degrees is effectively the difference in angle between the Earth's north-south axis, one solstice to the next, the summer to the winter. And so, you know, what I found amongst all of these religions was this symbolism of sacred time, which was the 47-degree angles in terms of outlines of their deities or their, you know, parts of their leader. They put the serpent, you know, in between these solstice extremes, and the serpent is the equinox symbol. So you see this in terms of pharaohs' heads. You see this in Uxmal. You've been there yourself on the east side of the nunnery quadrangle there. You've got these V-shaped angles with Kukulkan's head in the middle. So, you know, this is effectively the pharaoh's head turned upside down. You then go to South America in the Chavín culture in Chavín de Junta. You've got the Raymond de Stella. So you've got this ugly-looking serpent deity standing there holding two cactus staffs. And there are these 47-degree angle layers of electromagnetic coils and three serpent heads. So, you know, you see that at the beginning of the pre-Inca. You come to Biracocha on the gateway of the sun at Tiwanaku. And, you know, Biracocha was the guy who evolved out of all of these precursor pre-Incan deities, these, you know, laid head and staff deities, and you know he's littered with this 47-degree symbolism, serpent symbolism, and you know an Adamantina columbrina, you know the DMT hallucinogen. So what these guys all did, you see it in India as well, is they embedded three things together. It was always the deity and or the leader in conjunction with sacred time symbols, in conjunction with entheogens or hallucinogens, these neurochemicals. And that's the, I call it the triadic fingerprint common to these four different sun god religions.
Now, have you used a magnometer or any sensing devices at any of these locations to see if you could have actually measurable fields?
Not yet. No, I'm. How do we call it? I'm a poor archaeologist. So the thing that I do, Cliff, is I use the field of science. I look at geology, and you'd be surprised what data has been accumulated in other fields of science.
Okay, like what? When you say that, I mean, well, in terms of measure. We're talking about measuring telluric geomagnetic fields in these sacred locations. That's what I'm just interested in hearing.
Yeah,
about.
Look, I've not specifically measured or associated magnetic fields with these sites. That's not my field of science. What I've done is I've said that the Earth is a magnet. It's bathed in magnetic fields. That's a function of the structure of having a molten iron core and interacting with the sun. So wherever you are on the face of the planet, you experience these magnetic fields. And it's just that there are areas where there are hot spots. And so you go into the geology and you say, what is the rock type here? You know, is it granite? Is it limestone? Is it volcanic rock? So wherever you see fault lines, wherever you see, iron-containing rock, you know the magnetic fields are going to be strong. Around the poles, we know the magnetic fields are strong. You know, as I say, Sedona Vortex, we know that there. But have I got, you know, specifically measured this? No. And that's not, if you like, part of this particular project.
Well, that's more on a technical side. Now, you, in some ways, maybe you have, though, because you have actually sat and meditated and had the actual sensation, physical sensation at a number of these places. So, I believe you write a little bit about that. Let's talk about the altered states of consciousness and what you believe was the one of the main purposes of some of these complexes.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, for me, when you look at these places, you know, first off, they were places where religion was conducted. They were the epicenters of their societies. And the thing that, you know, all of these pyramids share in common is they were places of sensory silence. So, you know, the Maya built these massively thick walls that allowed them to basically get away from the noise of the jungle and the noise of their societies. In Egypt, you see a lot of underground chambers or tunnels under pyramids. Some of them you will see, you know, chambers in the pyramids. And so they built these, you know, ultimately we evolved from, you know, being in caves where, you know, shamans and Maya conducted their ritual ceremonies. We then got into digging tunnels underground, and you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, under the Pyramid of the Serpent at Teotihuacan. We then moved to pyramid chambers and, you know, chambers and tunnels underneath pyramids. And then, you know, given the cost of building these things, we then moved to temple structures. So we built these temples with outer structures and then inner temple sanctums. And the thing they share in common is sensory isolation or sensory silence. And, you know, as you also mentioned, you know, these were places where they meditated. So it is the silence and the meditation. We know that, you know, that's the gateway process. We access consciousness. It's not something we dial into externally. It's something that isn't driving our entire existence, but we're blind to it. And so, you know, what these guys realized is that, you know, meditation was discovered thousands of years ago as a process that was useful for helping access consciousness. And, you know, it could be made, you know, it could be augmented or it could be supplemented with neurochemicals, with, you know, solstice and equinox, you know, times of the year. And, you know, ultimately it's around a gateway. You know, we're awake right now. You know, tonight we'll be asleep. And, you know, so there's particular things going on inside our body that allow those physiologies and those activities to happen. And the whole idea behind these meditating in sensory silence, doing that at sacred time, taking neurochemicals, is it gave us all the ingredients, what I would call the access codes to switch in consciousness.
In your research, you talk about the different layers of consciousness, states, altered states of consciousness. Do you find that the buildings by themselves greatly enhance altered consciousness, or is it just certain types of points of the year, like the equinox and the solstices and things like that?
You know, I mean, look, it's a good question, and the difficulty is, you know, no one ever lets you into these places by yourself. I've meditated, you know, I've probably spent in total, you know, 2 or 3 days meditating in the King's Chamber or under the Pyramid of Khafre. You know, I just go in there for 2 or 3 hours at a time, and, you know, it's possible to get to an incredibly deep state, and you feel the resonances of, you know, the sounds of tourists, certainly in the King's Chamber. So, you know, my view is yes, you know, this is, you know, Giza for me was a machine. And, you know, I posted something on this week, you know, on your site and a number of other sites, a little bit of a side topic. But I, you know, for me, I can, you know, and I've reverse engineered this ritual process, and I use this myself now to access altered states. And you know, like we were discussing the other day, if I just simply meditate, I cannot access altered states. If I were to take hallucinogens just by themselves, keep my eyes open, I'm not going to transcend. But if I combine eyes closed meditation, I've got my body aligned to Earth's magnetic axis, and I'm doing this at sacred time, I transcend nearly every time. Yeah. And so, you know, for me, I have, you know, these are the most mind-blowing experiences you will ever have in your life. Your life will never be the same again. And this is the thing that's been hidden from us by monotheistic religions. They took away from us our knowledge and our understanding that we have a fourth state of consciousness. And they kept it for themselves, effectively. And all I've done is to find this know-how, find this knowledge, put it in the public domain. And my job now is to teach people and help people utilize this so they can access consciousness themselves without having to give away their power to other people.
Okay, well, let's talk about these altered states of consciousness. How does one access altered states of consciousness? And more to the point, what is the fourth level, and what is the importance of that high level of fourth level consciousness, the altered states?
Sure. Look, you know, I think at a high level, just to put some, you know, some clarity, put some definition there for people listening in, because this is, how do we call it? It's a kind of a difficult concept to understand. But if you imagine right now, altered states, it's a state of consciousness very different from the awakened state. You're still very alert, still, your mind is very aware of what's going on. But what happens is you've transcended your identity. So in other words, your ego-based mind, the subject-object reality that we manifest in day-to-day life, you can transcend your body, so you're outside of your body. You transcend time, space, and your sensory boundaries. And, if you could imagine having the clarity of your mind but without the baggage of your body or the baggage of the life you have, then a number of phenomena happen. And those phenomena are either experienced within or beyond objective reality. And what I mean by that, for example, is we can experience time expansion. So, for example, we could go back to being a baby in our mother's womb. We could go back to being a baby in the birth canal. And it's these two areas that some humans suffer major pathologies. And, that's where Stanislav Grof comes in. People will experience prior incarnations and other lives. I've had that experience myself. Or you will go back into your deep ancestry. It could be way back to when we were, monkeys and trees. We will get an understanding of our evolutionary memory, and it's possible to time travel as well.
Let me just interrupt. Is this state of consciousness controllable, or is it random when you go into that state? Can you actually control what you're doing?
I think that's a very good question, and I can't fully answer that. I think a guy like Terence McKenna most certainly could, because he had a lot of experience. But what I would say is, what you've got to do is you've got to let go. You can't grab things. When this vista's flying at you in terms of, this is a thing, your eyes are closed. It's like having a TV screen in front of you. And so if you try to grab onto this stuff as it's flying by, it disappears from you. So meditation teaches you to let go and be in the now. So, you can navigate it. You can have some degree of control. But I think the intention you go in with beforehand is fundamentally important. So it's important to state your intentions. Why do you want to do this? And, for me, it's not about I want to go and see aliens or UFOs. It's around healing. First and foremost is we're all, humans are dysfunctional by the, by the very virtue of the lives that we lead. And it's possible to spiritually heal and open up all of our energy channels and use that to help us consciously evolve and personally mature. So, first intention.
It's interesting, something you just brought up. Go ahead and finish. I have a point. Well, let me just add this real quickly. The phenomenon of the Maya... The Maya have these phenomenal calculations that go back into, early history, thousands of years ago, and how they calculated that is not known. So you bring up an interesting question. Maybe they, in their ceremonies, they actually consciously went back to those early periods and experienced them, and then actually left that information on their stela, their standing stones.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Cliff. We think science is the only way to evolve or devolve information and knowledge today, but I think they access knowledge from the collective consciousness, and they do this using accessing altered states. So, I think the Mayan calendar is an interesting topic of discussion in its own right, but to focus it, I think, this is what happens. I've been the recipient of this sort of knowledge, that's helped raise my awareness, which has directed my efforts. So, I totally know this can happen.
Can you explain what the process is to go into this state of consciousness? I mean, obviously, you need to have, or would you say that a person needs to be a meditator to do it, or can they just close their eyes and access this?
It's fundamentally very difficult. I think if it was easy, we would have much more examples of mystic avatars like Jesus and Buddha and those sorts of, you know, advanced human beings, and we don't. Mm-hmm. And even when you look at today's meditation movement, we had this discussion the other day. It's incredibly difficult, you know, to transcend while you meditate. And I know, you know, people here who've been doing this for 40 years and they've only transcended 10 times. You know, I'm not far off that myself based on 18 months of experiences using this ritual process. So, you know, I tonight start my preparations for the equinox new moon ceremony next Wednesday, and I will fast for 3 days. So, you know, when you look through the ancient, you know, the cosmo-mythologies and things and through the literature, you know, fasting was a, you know, a very important part. This was also an incredibly sacred process. So it wasn't a social, recreational set and setting and have a couple of beers and a joint and, you know, Bob's your uncle, you know, I fly off into the stars. They took this incredibly seriously, and it underpinned their religion. So, you know, the sort of thing I do, I will step up my meditation to 2 hours a day. An hour in the morning at sunrise and sunset. I will have short bursts of meditation during the day. I'm in amongst nature. I'm reconnecting with nature and developing my awe of that, because when we do that, we weaken the ego mind. I will conduct a fire ceremony, invocation, and then I will get up at circa 4 o'clock next Wednesday morning, and I will take a pile of magic mushrooms that I've grown and prepared. And I've got a special spot in the cupboard. There are really, really thick concrete walls, so it's incredibly silent. And I point my chair at magnetic south to these volcanoes, and I start my meditation. And, you know, I lose track of time when I meditate anyway. But as soon as these mushrooms and the meditation and the silence, you know, it starts to kick in after 15 minutes, I'm off. I'm gone. You know, my body has disappeared. My mind is free. It's liberated. And, you know, you can have these experiences, the most mind-blowing bliss, love, consciousness experiences where you merge with, you know, with the Maker. We'll call it divine consciousness, with God, with Buddha. And you have this, you know, realization that you are God and God is you. And, it is the very fabric of your life. It drives everything that manifests in our life.
That's very interesting, but you're right, it's much more complex than just closing your eyes and counting backwards.
Well, it's taking meditation to the next level. You know, these guys in the ancient world were all meditating. And they were doing it in these places of sensory science. So we all must really, you know, from my point of view, we should ideally be practicing meditation in between solstices and the equinoxes. You know, you could take high doses of shrooms or high doses of LSD, and, you know, you can read the stuff on Shroomery or Arrowhead, and, you know, people have these profound experiences anyway without doing what I'm doing. But the point is that... you know, and that's more mystical or shamanic, you know, if you like. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think a small percentage of those people, you know, they transform their lives as well. But, you know, what I'm talking about here is a process that was developed with a high efficacy. It delivers altered states of consciousness. And, you know, it does at particular times of year.
Don't you think that pyramids or these other structures that were built over these geomagnetic fields were also designed for the different levels of consciousness? So in other words, if someone wasn't able to transcend into the fourth state, as you call it, they still were getting bathed in this energy and having an altered state of consciousness. And let me give you an example. In 1995, I first went to Cancun with a girlfriend, and it was my first opportunity to go to Chichen Itza. And at that time, you could climb to the top of the pyramid, El Castillo. And my girlfriend at the time had an experience that she definitely had she was on some kind of a psychotropic drug. But what was even more interesting is an hour later, she she started menstruating, having her period. And she had already had, you know, she told me, I was like, this is very odd. We need to go to the drugstore. But I'll never forget that, because she was experiencing, and I distinctly remember being bathed in some kind of a vibration when I was in that the top of that pyramid. So my question to you is, do you think that the various chambers and various outlets in these sacred sites were made for perhaps the common man also, not just the priests and the seers of these ancient people?
Okay, I think there's two questions in there, and I'm gonna take your first one. The simple answer is you know, I do believe that there are phenomena that are experienced in and around these structures that we don't and I don't really understand. And I mentioned to you earlier on, I've experienced altered states of consciousness on Tikal, and I had no hallucinogens or meditation inside me. So I kind of almost sunk into the top of the temple, and my body disappeared, and I had this most fantastic experience that at the time I didn't really have the language to describe. So I agree, things happen, and I also accept the fact that I'm only talking part of the story. I think there are other physics there, other scientific paradigms we don't yet understand, and they could be torsion field physics, for example, or as you say, telluric. You may very well be right, but what I do, Cliff, here is I come back to the biology, and I come back to what do we know, what does the science tell us is possible with the human body around consciousness, around tweaking it, and therefore I say, well, what are the levers that we know of? And again, it's possible there's a lot we don't know. But, the simple answer is I think you've got to keep an open mind. And I think, there's enough people around on the face of the planet saying they're having these incredible experiences at these sites. And I think we have to accept, that is infinitely possible.
Do you, as a scientist and looking at it from biology, do you think that the ancients had a understanding of physiology that we don't? As an example, the pineal gland is considered the sacred or the spiritual gland because it produces hormones and other secretions that we're not really familiar with. But those secretions have been noted for the ability to change consciousness. Do you think that perhaps the ancients not only knew that, but maybe were of a different makeup? And specifically, this comes back to a subject that's very open for a lot of discussion, which is these amazingly large-headed individuals who didn't have binding, but had perhaps brains that were 30 to 40% bigger, which means that maybe the pineal gland in these individuals was significantly bigger, so that their altered states maybe came to them much quicker, much easier, and they were of a different biology than we are today. That's kind of a complex question, but I think you got the basis of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Look, I think we said this before, is that they, in altered states of consciousness, they access knowledge and information. They had spirit guides who taught them and instructed them. How do you know how to prepare the ayahuasca, and mixture? It's a complex of two, and you have to go through a very complex process. How would you evolve that without some prior knowledge? And they got that knowledge from the spirit beings that they met in altered states. So I think the priesthoods were incredibly adept at accumulating this knowledge, and the sciences and things like that were revealed to them through altered states. I think as well, you look at who we are today. We've not genetically changed in tens of thousands of years. So we are the same people today as we were 5,000 years ago. So why wouldn't there be parts of those society who are incredibly smart? And so, there were scientists and clever people, clever engineers, scientifically curious people. There were autistic people with special rare gifts. And, of course these things, this knowledge and insight was part. It's just our 21st century arrogance that and the pedestal we sit on, thinking that we're at the pinnacle of, you know, societal evolution, and we're not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, yes, I believe that totally is possible. So you have a second part to that.
Yeah, and the second part is, I mean, do you get a sense? I mean, I remember there was a movie one time, and I can't remember the name of it, where Earth space people went to another planet, and they found alien technology, and one of the technology devices was to transmit knowledge and higher consciousness into the user of this apparatus, and when the humans put it on, it was so powerful, it either would kill you, or if you had the physiology to hold it strong or to deal with it, you had some information passed to you. And I guess my question to you is, do you get a sense that these ancient ruins may have been built by superior beings? In other words, you're talking about, well, we haven't changed in the last 10, 20,000 years, but if these originating beings, Earth beings, were of a different physiology, would they have been the ones who would have built these sites and have left powerful energy-emitting devices to change consciousness?
Yeah, as long as we're not talking aliens, because I...
No, we're not.
Absolutely don't believe. No, oh, good. Yes. You know, if you show me evidence, hard evidence, I can see with my own, you know, two eyes and discern, then that's a different story. But I think, you know, were there examples of, how do we call it, you know, freaks, if you like, of human evolution that had other capabilities and capacities, and it was easier to, you know, that could very well be. You know, we see these skull structures with elongated skulls, and, you know, was that part of a man-made process of wrapping the skull, or, you know, these just, you know, how do we call them, the next genetic variants that could have, you know, could have spawned a new species. That's possible. And I think, you know, for me, we've got to give credit to our ancestors. And our ancestors were a heterogeneous mix of different intelligences and, you know, how do we call it, different stages of evolution. And these were the guys who were solving problems in their own time, building these advanced structures. And, you know, I think by and large, you know, most of these were just places of sensory silence. They gave, you know, in the Maya, it gave them access to visibility to see time over the jungle. So they built these structures, you know, above the tree line. But I think places like Giza, you know, its interrelationships with the other pyramids, particularly Teotihuacan and Xi'an in China, I think they were part of a global geoengineering, you know, project. And, you know, therefore, it, you know, because if you look at the posting that I made on your site this week and other sites, you know, we're looking at mathematical interrelationships, sine wave metric interrelationships, you know, Earth circumference interrelationships that defy chance. And it says that we were doing incredible things. We had a grasp of science and technology. And, you know, just come to the basic observation. Why do you think the world's biggest Egyptology departments today are the Americans, the Germans, and the British? Yeah, have you thought about that for a moment?
I haven't, but of course those are the three countries that are, you know, there's, you know, a lot of cerebral processing through engineering, mathematics. You know, Americans are always thought of to be the epicenter for the new sciences a lot of times, and of course the Germans have always been quite great scientists, and the British also. So that's what I would think. If there's another aspect, then I'm not capturing it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so the link is World War II. And, you know, I know this was sort of, how do we call it, popularized in Indiana Jones, but the fact remains is all of these countries were very much focused on ancient Egypt. And, you know, today they have these, you know, rather large legacy Egyptology departments. And, you know, I think, you know, part of the war effort, it wasn't just, innovating with the science that we had and the frontiers of it, but it was also being very lateral in our thinking and looking to the ancient world for a source of technological competitive advantage. So, you know, when I've always looked at Giza very, very much like Chris Dunn. You know, I went to Giza saying, you know, given your broader interrelationships and the implied electromagnetic field physics, I'm coming to you to look at the possibility of you being a machine that generated electromagnetic waves. And, you know, the vet in me, you know, anatomy is the structure of function, physiology, the function of structure. I ripped it apart. And I looked at it in the way Chris did. I think, you know, he did a fantastic job with his research there. And I came to the same conclusion. This is a machine. It was a lightning generator generating these Schumann resonances. So instead of having to wait for the solstices or the equinoxes, they could switch it on whenever they wanted.
It's amazing. So much to talk about. Not enough time, unfortunately. Is there something you would like to leave us with, Carlton, in the last few minutes of our talk here that you find is the real basis for reading your book, Sun God, Sacred Secrets? What is the motivation for someone to go out and get your book?
Okay, sure. Look, I think twofold. You know, if you're really interested in how do we call it, novel, innovative, data-driven, science-driven answers to the ancient world, then you need to read this book. No one has written a book like this before. I think as well, the second big reason is, for me, this was a treasure hunt. I went looking for treasures, and my treasures weren't gold or lost civilizations. They were the secrets to accessing consciousness. And I've reverse engineered this ritual process, and it's the final chapter of the book. So that's the key for the book, if you're interested in understanding this. And then, I would encourage, check up on my website, www.carltonbrownv47.com, and also join my blog, because that blog will evolve this discussion on how we utilize these rituals to access altered states of consciousness. And this is something everyone can do within this lifetime. You don't need permission, and it's a very predictable, I believe, a safe process as long as you treat it in a healthy, respectful manner.
Okay. And I checked recently, and Sun God Secrets is on Amazon, but is there any place else? I guess you can probably... You can get it on your website, can't you? You can get it on your website.
Amazon, the iTunes, iTunes Connect, the iTunes bookstore, and it's also on Barnes & Noble as well. Books.
Right.
So those are the three main ones. And there is a version on Kobo, but I need to re-edit that. But I think for the best variant or best copy, it's on Amazon, and I will, within the next month, launch a hard copy book as well.
Okay, and how many pages is it approximately?
432.
Okay, and I want to let the audience know that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, it's simplified science. There's over 300 pictures and images in it. So a picture's worth 1,000 words, and it's but it is a book of science. There's quite a bit of data there, and it's about how you access altered states of consciousness.
And in its current state, I would like to let everyone know that it's a digital book. It's an e-book, and it is in formatted for Kindle, and it's quite reasonable. It's $10, and for 422-page book, that's quite a deal, I'm sorry, happy to say. So we're in luck until Carlton decides to print, publish a hard copy, and then I'm sure it'll be three times the cost. So. Get the e-version now. Of course, you don't want to hear that.
Indeed. Look, we face certain constraints with Amazon. So, $10 for the book is the price at where it sits. You know, I think it is good value for money considering the knowledge you get. The paperback will be around $25. It'll be in black and white as well.
Okay. One other thing, Carlton, in the book, do you have a section on reaching altered states of consciousness that is like a what do you call it, a cliff notes of it, so people can kind of go, okay, I close my eyes,
yes.
I go here, I, okay, you
exactly.
do.
Exactly. This is the final chapter. It's all there, and check out my blogs. I give you a blow-by-blow recipe on how to do this stuff.
Okay, good, excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure. Oh, before I let you go, are you going to be speaking anywhere? Do you have any new books coming out? And, of course, this is a time to promote any new work or appearances, TV, radio, whatever.
At the moment, you know, how do we call it? I'm just beginning this one-to-many marketing, so this is going to evolve over the next 12 months, but I will publish, you know, my travel conference itinerary on my website in due course. I am working on a second book at the moment, and, you know, I promise that to be quite a controversial book. And it's really looking at, you know, I think there are three things we need to learn from our past, and this is one of the other things that I believe we really need to learn and is very pertinent for the world that we live in today. So, you know, that relates to global climate change, and I expect that book to be out probably in about a year's time.
Okay, excellent. The book is Sun God, Sacred Secrets, The Archaeology, Art and Science of Altered States of Consciousness. The author is Carlton Brown. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I am going to post this link to this audio, but also, as usual, we have notes from our conversation with Carlton, which will be on our the Facebook page, and I will take a couple of the sections of photographs, maybe three or four, from our discussion today, from the book, to kind of give you a sense of what you can get when you purchase this book and the contents. So thank you very much, Carlton. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much as well, Cliff, and thank you very much to the listeners out there for attending today. Greatly appreciate it.
Right. Thanks. As a reminder, next week my guest is William Vail, who is an archaeologist who has studied South America and has found some phenomenal ruins. And not only ruins, he has found a number of surface geo designs, geo reliefs, that are only seen from very high elevations. In other words, they were designed for, who knows, craft flying above the surface of the planet. And I hope you join us next week. So have a great day.